If you're interested in what China's doing in Africa and the Global South, you're going to want to subscribe to the China-Africa Project. We've indexed every major news story going back years, and it's easily searchable by country, topic, or keyword. Plus, we're the only source for daily analysis on all of the big stories related to Chinese engagement in Africa and throughout the developing world. With a subscription, you'll enjoy full access to the site. Plus, you'll get our popular daily email newsletter that comes out every morning at 6 a.m. Washington time. Subscriptions start at just $7 a month for students and teachers and $15 a month for everyone else. To sign up, just go to ChinaAfricaProject.com/subscribe. Once again, that's ChinaAfricaProject.com/subscribe.
The China in Africa podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Africa-China Reporting Project at Wits University in Johannesburg. The ACRP aims to improve the quality of reporting on Africa-China relations through reporting grants, workshops, and other opportunities for journalists. More information at africachinareporting.co.za and our dedicated training website at africachinatraining.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the China in Africa podcast, a proud member of the Seneca Network from SubChina. I'm Eric Olander, and as always, I'm joined by Kobus van Staden, the senior China-Africa researcher at the South African Institute of International Affairs in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good afternoon to you, Kobus.
Good afternoon.
Kobus, we have survived FOCAC week. It was a very long week, but we did it. We cranked out weeks and weeks of stories and podcasts and all the shows. And then the week came and it didn't disappoint in many respects. So that was very exciting. For our folks over on our Patreon community, we have been posting regular updates and we have a Zoom call scheduled for Friday with all of our community. If you would like to join our Patreon community and people like Stephen, who's our newest member this week, we would love to have you part of us. Check it out at patreon.com/ChinaAfricaProject. Lots of great stuff going on over there. And we just love the fact that people are supporting the show and having a great conversation. And we're doing these Zoom calls, which is super fun. So we're going to be talking about FOCAC today in the show. It wrapped up with the publication of a 40-page action plan, plus three other documents that are all now available on our Twitter page. And I say that only because finding the actual documents themselves was incredibly difficult. All the China watching and China Africa watching community was kind of messaging each other going, where can we find these things? They didn't actually publish them online at the end of the summit, which is a little bit unusual because normally communiques are published. We got our hands on them. I've put them to the top of our Twitter feed at China AFR Project. You can find them there. The highlight of the event, though, came on Monday when Chinese President Xi Jinping delivered his keynote address. And in that speech, he outlined a financial plan worth at least $40 billion. Now, that number is a bit of a sensitive issue. Both the Financial Times and Bloomberg almost immediately jumped on the fact that the number is actually a drop from the $60 billion figure of the previous two FOCACs. Let me just quickly walk you through what the numbers were that he outlined and also why you may want to hold judgment as to whether or not it's a decrease, because it may not actually be a decrease. So let's take a look at here's how it broke down. When it comes to credit lines, in 2018, the Chinese offered $20 billion. In the 2021 FOCAC, this week, Xi Jinping announced $10 billion of credit lines. Grants and interest-free loans, $15 billion back in 2018, zero this time. No grants, no interest-free loans. Chinese firms' investments, these are credits to promote Chinese investment, $10 billion in 2018, unchanged in 2021. So right now, our tally right now is $20 billion total. Development financing, $10 billion back in 2018, none in 2021. So, Kobus, those are the loans that are used for the infrastructure development. That is the clearest indication that the Chinese are backing away from those large-scale infrastructure projects. Financing African exports, here's an interesting one. It doubled from $5 billion to $10 billion this year. And something new this year that President Xi announced was that China would allocate 25% of its special drawing rights from its International Monetary Fund allocation to Africa, amounting to $10 billion. That is new. That did not happen last time. So all of that added up together is $40 billion. That's how Bloomberg and the FT and pretty much everybody in the narrative is talking about $40 billion. But hold on, there's more, as they say on TV. But wait, there's more. The most important announcement, though, was Xi Jinping's pledge to distribute 1 billion COVID vaccines to Africa within the next 3 years. 600 million doses would be shipped from China, and 400 million would be manufactured locally on the continent through joint ventures with Chinese companies. Okay, that 600 million one is the key one to focus on. So the team at China Africa Advisory in Germany, they pointed out something very interesting. They said, hold on. Don't close out the tab yet on that $40 billion, because it depends how Beijing prices the value of those donated 600 million doses. If they price it at around $33 a dose, which is what Sinopharm charged Hungary, and we've seen similar rates for Sinopharm sales in Africa, then that's worth about $19.8 billion, which will bring us right back to $60 billion. So again, this is not necessarily what's going to be paid. This is just an accounting tactic, but they have a way to get back to $60 billion if they price those Sinopharm vaccines at around $30 to $33. Now, no one's saying they're actually going to do this. The point here is that we should hold on, take a breath. The numbers usually take 2 to 3 weeks to settle down. We haven't heard a lot of information coming out of Beijing as to what the final numbers are. So just take a breather. And if you see these stories that China's backing away, China's not spending as much, you may want to hold judgment, because those vaccines may make up the difference. Now, as FOCAC was going on, there was a lot of other stuff going on. And right in the aftermath of FOCAC this week, a lot was going on. It was a very, very busy week. Let's start on, was this Wednesday? Right after, and we did not hear that this was going to happen, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, instead of heading straight back home, he headed to Ethiopia, where he made a very interesting stop in Addis Ababa. This has a lot of ramifications, both geopolitically in terms of the disputes with the United States, but also a very, very clear statement of support for the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Let's take a listen to the key reason, the most important reason for why Foreign Minister Wang Yi went to Addis Ababa. Here's him at his press conference in the foreign ministry in Addis Ababa.
China does not interfere in other countries' internal affairs. Surely, we don't interfere in the internal affairs of Ethiopia as well. And what we stand against is interference in Ethiopia's domestic affairs. In our view, essentially what is happening inside Ethiopia is its domestic affairs. So it's our hope, and we are also confident, that Ethiopia has the ability and wisdom to find the solutions to stabilize the situation and address this issue through dialogue and negotiation and through legal and political means.
This is a very important statement from Wang, and it's really a strong pushback against the United States, which China accuses of enacting unilateral sanctions against Ethiopia. Also, China has been pushing back hard on European pressure and the isolation that the Ethiopian government is starting to feel. One of the key points that I made in today's newsletter was there's a lot of alignment now between China and Ethiopia. And really, the relationship seems to be deepening amidst this crisis. Okay, but that wasn't it. Right on the same day, on Tuesday, this was the closing day of the FOCAC ceremony. Over in Brussels, the European Union announced their new Global Gateway Initiative. Now, this was something that we've been hearing about for several weeks now, but they chose a very interesting day to do it on the last day of FOCAC. Don't know if that timing was coincidental or not, but it certainly was interesting. Ursula von der Leyen, who's the president of the European Commission, she made the announcement from the European Union headquarters.
Global Gateway is the European Union's plan, or you may call it roadmap, for major investment in infrastructure development around the world. We want to take a different approach. We want to show that a democratic, value-driven approach can deliver on the most pressing challenges. We want to show that it can, on one hand, meet local needs, but also, on the other hand, tackle the global challenges we have. And thus, in a way, also, of course, benefit the European Union. because Global Gateway is also about our strategic interests around the world. We're not alone. We have like-minded partners that are planning the same. I have co-hosted together with President Biden at COP26 a meeting, an event exactly on that topic. The Americans call their initiative Build Back Better World, but we are also aligning with our British friends with Clean Green. So it is for us important to make sure that there is a different way to deliver in this infrastructure globally and to show that mainly democracy, value-driven investments can deliver on the ground.
So Kobus, a whole lot of coded language there, different from China. She was very explicit in her follow-up Q&A with the press that this was an alternative to China. She mentioned China by name several times in the Q&A, this emphasis on values and on democracies. This is something we're also hearing out of the White House, but a lot of that talk earlier this week as well. And finally, Kobus, as if that wasn't enough, there was the drama that's been unfolding for the past 2 weeks, but really exploded last Sunday and into Monday in Uganda over the fate of the Entebbe International Airport. The Daily Monitor newspaper ran an absolutely atrocious story, just shoddy journalism up and down, with headlines that were alarmist and actually not true, saying that the airport had been seized and would be forfeited to the Chinese for failure to repay debts. And this sparked a whole other controversy about the debt trap narrative that in some ways did cloud the FOCAC events. And a lot of the media coverage, particularly in the US and Europe, did make references to what was happening in Uganda. We wrote a story on Monday that debunked all of it. In fact, the loan hasn't even expired out of its grace period yet. I mean, it couldn't have been seized. They haven't even started to service the loan. I mean, there was so much shoddiness in this reporting. And that, unfortunately, leads us to the point that a lot of these stories are just not well understood by the journalists who are covering them. And it leads to this kind of situation. Okay, Kobus. Holy Moses, I didn't expect to take all this time to go through everything that happened this week, but it was so jam-packed. I thought we were only going to talk about FOCAC, but we can't simply because of all of the other big things going on. Take it away. Where do you want to start?
Well, maybe we can start with FOCAC itself and then circle back to all these other things. I completely share your caution about the numbers, and I think it's really important to wait a little bit to see how these numbers are going to shake out, not only in relation to the vaccines, which I think is a big thing. I mean, that's a large amount of money, but also throughout Xi Jinping's speech, he kept announcing 10 of these kind of projects, 10 connectivity projects, 10 governance projects, 10 green energy projects. So I never 100% kind of understood through all, looking through all of these FOCAC documents, which budget exactly are those projects coming out of? What kind of projects are they going to be? How big are they going to be? And then crucially, how are they going to be funded? That I think is another kind of big issue.
But to be fair, you would never get that kind of detail from a presidential address.
Well, that's exactly why I think it's important to wait for the numbers to settle, because as you said, the kind of 40 billion number that FT and other people went with is a number that essentially was put together from pulling little bits from his speech, and a lot of what he announced in his speech didn't have numbers attached to them, so that I think will be really interesting. What's struck me also in his speech, particularly then also following up his speech with reading the action plan, which, as you said, it's 40 pages. It's a lot more detailed and a lot more kind of broader than the action plans from previous FOCACs that I remember reading. And it's really a kind of interesting kind of spread of cooperation. Like you really get a kind of a very interesting kind of glimpse of how broad the relationship actually is. And there's all kinds of initiatives where I'm like, what is that? For example, I saw there's supposed to be, they're setting up or it's happening or something, I'm not actually sure, a China-Africa forum for law school deans. Which is just one of a myriad of initiatives, and again, you're like, who is arranging all of these? Who is paying for all of them? It's really kind of interesting to read.
Well, I found that the Dakar Action Plan really did fulfill the expectation that we reached an inflection point in the China-Africa relationship. We took a turn with this FOCAC. This was a very different FOCAC than previous ones. Number one, as we talked about leading into it, everybody was in alignment. There was no dissent. Everybody was on the same page. We had nobody break out and criticize. I mean, it is incredible the discipline on the African side and the Chinese side. We knew nothing of these things going into it. There was no leaks. There was no hints. Nothing. So number one, I thought that was very impressive. Number two, the priorities have changed and clearly have changed. We're not seeing the big infrastructure projects. We're not seeing these big, massive loans that are coming through, in part because I think African stakeholders told the Chinese, we simply can't carry the debts and we can't service the debts, especially now in the pandemic era, leading into the post-pandemic era. The economies are going to slow. The currencies are under strain. It's simply not going to be possible. So I didn't like the narrative that people were saying, well, because they're spending less money, that means they're pulling back. They're spending less money in part because the capacity of a lot of African governments to process this money is simply not there, especially now. And I felt that the priorities outlined in both Xi's speech and in the action plan did tend to mirror the priorities that African prime ministers and presidents have said they want. Jobs, digital infrastructure, green energy. These are smaller, lighter initiatives that have big impact in the short term and in the immediacy. That is what's so critical.
Yeah, I agree. You know, kind of adding to that, I think the kind of emphasis on Chinese companies leading investment is interesting. You know, obviously that is a continuation from before, but there's a shift of emphasis there, I think, which it kind of makes me wonder, you know, a lot of kind of Western observers have, as you said, have characterized this as a kind of a pullback. It, for me, it seems more like a kind of a, you know, the cliche of that the Chinese always use, that you know, kind of that they crossing the river by feeling the stones. This seems to me a dynamic adaptation, you know, to looking back at 20 years of this kind of large project, large infrastructure focus, Chinese state bank financed focus of the relationship, and kind of taking a step away from it and looking at, you know, at other and more innovative ways of financing some of these things, pulling in a much broader range of financiers, as we've already seen developing over the last 2 years or so. And then you know, kind of there was also very, like, the other very, very kind of intriguing one was the mention of money that was going to go to African financial institutions and kind of support for African financial institutions. And I saw some people on Twitter was raising the possibility, like asking whether this means that there might be some, like, Africa, like, new development, like, financing institutions that, like, be, you know, can maybe on the cards in the future, or simply kind of like newer kind of support for existing ones. So, you know, it seems like there's a kind of a pivot towards other forms of financing initiatives in Africa that don't necessarily just, like, run according to the kind of the conventional kind of state bank finance model.
Let's get two perspectives now. And Kobus, I want you to sound off after hearing each of them. I tried to pick one that was favorable to what happened at FOCAC this week and one that was a little bit more critical. Let's start with the more favorable review. This comes from Martin Davies, who's the Managing Director of Emerging Markets in Africa at Deloitte Africa, a longtime China-Africa specialist. In fact, Kobus, he goes back to the early days. I mean, he was one of the first who has been covering this issue and thinking about these issues dating back two and a half decades now. And so he spoke with South African Broadcasting Corporation, SABC News, that's your national broadcaster. And let's take a listen to his reflection, and then I'd like to hear what you have to say.
If we take it back to the year 2000, I was a youngster then and still am, and I was at the first China-Africa summit in Beijing in October 2000 and attended many of the subsequent triannual summits. And it certainly has been, thinking back, it's been the mega trend of our generation, hasn't it? China's engagement of our continent. China has become, the last decade at least, the single largest trading partner, the largest sovereign lender to African governments, the single largest investor by many counts, and certainly the single largest financier of infrastructure. So China's engagement is clearly pervasive. and from top to bottom and east to west of the continent. You know, the model of engagement, the strategy of engagement is continuously being updated. And that is something you cannot say, arguably, for many traditional actors.
I think he's absolutely right. That's what this action plan, this 40-page action plan, is an updated version of what they've done previously. What are your thoughts about Martin's assessment?
It's very similar to points that Tang Shaoyang made in a recent conversation with us. You know, that there is this kind of continuation from the past. Like they don't kind of, no kind of folk makes a radical jump into a new field. There's always like this very similar language, very similar kind of themes. Yet each one is a kind of a new iteration of it. And you can see kind of dynamically adapting, you know, kind of two different kind of issues and pulling in new issues, particularly, you know, also as African kind of partners raise them. It's you know, I agree. And I also agree with his point that this really is the biggest story. I mean, we always say that the Africa-China relationship is the biggest story of the 21st century. But I think, you know, from an African perspective, at least, it really is a completely different era compared to its relationship with other external actors.
It is transformational, and he's absolutely right. But you know, we just spoke with somebody in Egypt earlier today, and she was saying that nobody talks about China. Nobody knows about China. And the knowledge deficit there is as severe as it is anywhere on the continent. And it just is still kind of alarming to me that the news coverage this week in African media of FOCAC was basically non-existent.
Yeah, I was also shocked by that. Like, it was really, like, really? You know, it's just, yeah.
Nobody covered it. I get it that maybe the Washington Press, and I'm surprised, honestly, that the Washington Post, who has a West Africa correspondent, did not cover it. The New York Times did not cover it.
Yeah, I was looking at the New York Times, and it was so revealing. Like, they, you know, I was looking at what they covered for Africa over the last week, and it was six different Omicron like COVID stories, and not to mention a FOCAC. And you know, I was like, well, there you go.
France 24's English service did not cover it. And the French service, they did a full hour in prime time, nothing in the English. But in the African media, nobody covered it. I mean, very, very little. In fact, what was so...
The South Africans covered it a little bit, but not... No, it wasn't...
But they used a lot of agency material to cover it. They didn't send their own reporters. They didn't have their own stringers. It was... They used AP, Reuters, and AFP in a lot of it. It's just... I don't get it. I just don't get it.
Well, partly a part of that is budgets.
It may be budget.
Like African, they can't send, like the SABC doesn't have the money to send a journalist to Dakar.
Maybe, but you can get a freelancer and a stringer. They can afford that. And especially for an event this big that comes once every 3 years, this is like the Olympics, that even SABC and its financial woes can afford a stringer, but they didn't do it. The Daily Nation didn't have much coverage. It was basically as if it wasn't happening. So I was kind of perplexed by that. Again, I expect that from the Western media. I did not expect that from the African media. Let's take now, again, some of the more negative aspects of it. What was not discussed, barely any mention of debt. She made this, you know, very offhanded comment in the speech that we're working with our African partners on debt relief. They repeated that they're going to cancel some of the interest-free grants, the zero-interest loans. That, of course, is a small, single-digit portion of their broader loan portfolio. That has been one of the key concerns from African stakeholders, especially in those 10 or 11 states that are suffering from very high debt servicing costs right now and lots of pressure. This, again, was a celebration of state-to-state relations. We had almost no civil society engagement. There was an entrepreneurial summit a parallel to it, but we did not hear the kind of voices from the youth that, for example, we heard with French President Emmanuel Macron, who really opened up on the French president. Now, we would never see something like that in a Chinese context, but we certainly did not hear from NGOs, from civil society, from any other participants that were not approved by either the state actors on the African side or the Chinese government itself. So let's hear from a more dissenting point of view, a little bit of disappointment, not a dissent, disappointment is the right word, from Professor Carlos Lopez at the University of Cape Town. He was speaking in a webinar with the Atlantic Council, which is a Washington, D.C. think tank. And let's take a listen to what he had to say about FOCAC.
Well, if I take into account the speech by President Xi Jinping, I must express a bit of disappointment. I think not for the reasons that most people will probably mention, because I think it's not different from what other donors and other partners of the continent say. Is, you know, the numbers are more impressive, probably.
Yep.
But, you know, this, they are not coming with a structurally different proposal for engagement with Africa, as it was the case in the previous FOCAC, where, you know, they were mentioning of structural transformation aspects, like, you know, accelerating industrialization. Now there is a passing remark on industrialization. When we talk about the vaccines, it's basically about, you know, distributing manufactured vaccines in China is not very different from distributing manufactured vaccines from pharmaceuticals in Western countries. So it's about Africa as a consumption market. It's not Africa as an opportunity for structural transformation. So that is a disappointment.
Africa as a consumption market and not an opportunity for structural transformation. What say you, Cobus?
I see his point, you know, and to a certain extent, I agree with him. On the other hand, I mean, one has to also say that you know, a whole bunch of those vaccines are supposed to be manufactured in Africa, you know, albeit by Chinese manufacturers. And it is a continuation of manufacturing facilities that they are setting up in Africa that we've been covering, you know, kind of over the last year. I agree I also was struck by that there was less language about industrialization. I think I read it as partly that the kind of flagship industrialization initiative, you know, in Ethiopia is facing kind of uncertain days because Ethiopia is facing uncertain days. And, you know, but there was also the main part where I would differ with Carlos is that compared to the traditional partners to Africa, i.e. Western countries, particularly when one reads the action plan, I think the relationship is just a lot broader, or there's just a lot more packed in there, and not only that not only in terms of themes that they would like to cover, but in terms of initiatives, fine-grained initiatives already kind of being, you know, kind of being kind of listed. You know, there I think lies the big contrast with both the EU's, you know, kind of a gateway plan and with Build Back Better World, is that all of those plans are cast in future terms. You know, kind of, it's going to be this, it's going to be that, it's going to be values, it's going to be, you know, kind of infrastructure is, you know, whereas like with the Chinese, I think the big contrast is it's a billion different things, all itemized and listed in detail, you know. So the kind of, I think, and Henry Tugendhat, who we had on the podcast a while ago, he and a co-author, who I'm blanking on her name, apologies, they recently made the point that you know, that compared to these other partners, the fine-grainedness and the level of development of the relationships on all different levels, from state to state, to provincial government, to private sector, to, you know, all of these different relationships are so well developed by now that is, I think, the big contrast, I think, with the other donors.
Yeah, I think that as the United States and Europe want to step in the ring and try to compete directly with China on these issues of infrastructure, they're going to set themselves up for direct comparisons. So as you pointed out, a lot of what the United States and Europe are doing is talking about things in the future tense. Even Ursula von der Leyen, she said it'll take about a year for them to raise the money for the first tranche of $60 billion. That's a long time in politics. And we don't know anything about B3W, but we're going into a very treacherous political season in the United States when the Republicans likely take control of the legislative branch of the government, which is what we're expecting in the midterm elections. Will they support a Biden initiative like this? We just don't know. So everything is uncertain. So the Chinese, what we do know is that the vaccines are going to start flowing in very, very large numbers. Professor Carlos Oya over at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, he said something very interesting on the reaction to the vaccines. Boy, he said, if the Chinese can pull this off and bring in a billion vaccines, they're going to make everybody look terrible if they can make that scale. One of the points that I brought up, which did spark some ire from our friends in Ethiopia, was that the situation in Ethiopia is fluid right now. Addis Ababa does look stable, and certainly Bole International Airport does look very stable, but should the security situation deteriorate there, should, maybe, I'm not saying it will, the logistics operation for that cold chain air bridge that Cainiao, which is the logistics arm of Alibaba, built with Ethiopian Airlines, does go through Addis Ababa. So one has to think, will the Chinese diversify that logistics network coming into Kenya, into Ghana, into other points, maybe South Africa, to distribute some of those vaccines as well? So very interesting points there. On the question of the detailed plan, Cobus, this is something that I thought was very interesting. When we talk about the Chinese versus the Americans, the Japanese, and TCAT is another example of this, the Chinese are putting cash on the table right now. I mean, $40 billion is an enormous amount of money in an African context, in any context right now. $40 billion is a lot more than I thought that they were going to come to the table with. It's way more than, again, other partners have come with. When we talk about what the Europeans are doing, $300 billion is worldwide. This is $40 billion just from 2022 to 2024. So that time frame is much more compressed. That's a lot of cash.
Yeah, and only for Africa. Yeah.
Yeah, only for Africa. So I thought it was kind of crappy, honestly. And again, I'm not saying this to defend the Chinese, so that's not it. But the negative theme on so much of the coverage out of the US and Europe on this, which was like, you know, the numbers down, debt, sustainability, all these things. You know that if the Americans announced a $40 billion package for Africa, that they would be singing to the high heavens about how amazing it is.
Well, and imagine how difficult it would be for Biden to pass $40 million to Africa now, you know?
No way.
Yeah, I mean, on the debt issue, like the debt section of the action plan is pretty funny to read, actually, because it's like so much of it is making the point that the Chinese worked very well with the G20's DSSI initiative, and that they fully implemented, and you know, so it was clearly like kind of pushing back against all of this criticism they got for the DSSI. So yeah, it's kind of the action, you know, for someone who, you know, if you happen to have a taste to for this kind of, you know, kind of way that the language kind of manifests, you know, like against the background of like all of these controversies, then the action plan is pretty funny to read, actually, in some cases. But yeah, like, you know, kind of I think the additional issue with the European and American initiatives is, you know, like I don't want to diss them, because in the first place, no one knows yet what they're going to be. And also they could well be great. You know, they could well like do amazing stuff. But the amount of kind of talk about democracies and values and so on makes me wonder, you know, kind of how the country selection for these different projects are going to happen. And it also makes me wonder, like, who is going to count as democratic enough? And then it also makes me wonder, like, you know, because of all the values language, I was kind of wondering whether the values language is going to be welded onto kind of strategic preoccupations of that these countries have, you know, kind of in particular parts of the global south. So, you know, which is a kind of a long-winded way of saying that it's not necessarily that just because, for example, building a water treatment facility in Malawi is a good thing to do, is necessarily that's what they're going to do, you know. So the fact that the Chinese engagement is so, or has traditionally been so, demand driven and so kind of led by the kind of priorities of recipient governments, you know, was, you know, that itself was a kind of a game changer. And then now that kind of model, that funding model is shifting, I think it's going to be very interesting to see whether that kind of aspect of it continues. You know, is it still going to be a situation where if country X wants a port and they are willing and they you know, kind of they are willing to, and able to support the loan, that they will just simply be able to get that loan from the Chinese, and, you know, kind of, or whether there's going to be an additional set of kind of hoops, to jump through. And that then I think kind of like it may well kind of play into the point, that Carlos raised earlier, in terms of China kind of moves shifting towards being more of a conventional donor.
Well, interestingly, we got a little sneak peek of that because there was a lot of pictures, more pictures than I expected, actually, of Wang Yi and his talks with various African delegations. And one of the things we got to see was some of the pitches that African governments were making to the Chinese, almost like an episode of Shark Tank, where people kind of come up with their idea and they have 60 seconds to make the pitch. So we saw, for example, this great post that Fola Sharisule at Oxford University, she posted a retweet of Sierra Leone kind of came with their transportation initiatives, and they actually held the picture up with between Wang Yi and the foreign minister from Sierra Leone. And the thing that Fola Shade pointed out was that this is how a lot of these initiatives start, which is just with a very quick 60-second elevator pitch, and then it kind of proceeds from there. We also saw the Democratic Republic of Congo, the foreign minister, pitched the whole industrialization plan for the Congo to the Chinese delegation. There was a number of different ministries that were there, and they said in a Radio Okapi piece that we featured today in the newsletter how they're hoping to get a slice of some of these $10 billion initiatives, these various different pockets and pools of money that are now available. So I think a lot of that was going on this week, was pitching for these various projects. They're all going to be smaller scale and they're going to be spread more thinly, but still very interesting. And again, I think this comes back to how the Chinese, again, have a plan and they've put money behind that plan and people can see it. And I have a feeling that next year at this time, a lot of these initiatives will have shovels in the ground already. And then that's going to put real tangible pressure on the United States and Europe to actually deliver and walk the walk.
Yeah, this is also, I was wondering like what you made of some of the initiatives in the action plan that or the kind of, kind of like sections of the action plan where they were saying they're planning cooperation on issues that have over the last while been extremely controversial in relation to China in Africa. So one is that they're planning to work on anti-corruption, which was funny to, considering that it came out in roughly this, like within the same, a few days of these kind of revelations of massive kind of probably Chinese fund like aided corruption in the Democratic Republic of Congo, albeit kind of during the Kabila era, but still. And then also that they're going to be working on maritime governance, when the Chinese are widely, like massively criticized for kind of overfishing and other kinds of maritime kind of offenses all around the coast of Africa. Like, I was wondering what you made of those kinds of like initiatives.
Two key points on this. One, we have extended invitations to the authors of the Congo Holdup Report, which is, if you're not familiar with this, is a fascinating report on the corruption during the Kabila administration, not exclusively focused on the Chinese, all sorts of corruption, but they do spend a lot of time on the Sicko Means deal. We've got invitations out to the Century, which is a group based in Washington, D.C., and the Bloomberg reporting team. We're waiting to hear back from them about when that will come. So we want to bring you some shows on this story as well. Interestingly, I had some conversations with folks in the DRC about the story, and they kind of laughed, Cobus, about it. They're like, yeah, I mean, people have been reporting the corruption story between the Chinese and Sicko Means going all the way back to Africa Confidential covering it in 2010 for much larger amounts than actually were uncovered by the Congo Holdup team. And they were like, really? You guys are surprised that there's corruption in the DRC and that the Chinese paid backdoor deals to get this? That's still something new. And at the same time, and I don't know if this was coincidental or not, but the provincial governor of Lualaba province, which is the heart of the mining zone, the cobalt mining belt, she met with the president of the Congolese Senate this week and representatives from Sicko Means and said, we want to put all of this behind us. We want to get on with it. That was very interesting as well. Again, I don't know if it was timed with the Congo Holdup. I don't know if it was timed with FOCAC, whatever it was. But when you hear senior level Congolese politicians saying, let's put this behind us, you know that these reports do not have much traction in the Congo. And Sicko Means put up a pro forma denial saying it was Westerners trying to divide. They had all the speculation that it was malintentioned people, all these different, the typical kind of denial from a Chinese kind of stakeholder on these things. They said, we've not engaged in any corruption. This is just all made up fantasy. They, you know, one of the words that they like the most, which I get a kick out of, is they use the word umpteenth time. I always think that's funny. You know, that's umpteenth. Like, okay. For the umpteenth time, we're saying that we did not do this. So, okay. Very quickly, also in the Democratic Republic of Congo, while we are there, another big event happened this week. The Chinese embassy in Kinshasa issued an advisory to all of its nationals in three eastern Congolese provinces, Ituri, North Kivu, and South Kivu, that they have until December 10th to evacuate and to get out. And they also identified seven cities and towns in those provinces that they said immediately you must leave. And that is in response to the worsening security situation that's there. A number of Chinese have been kidnapped and attacked. And they said if you don't leave by December 10th, next week, then there is nothing we can do and you are on your own. So that was a big escalation in terms of the warnings coming from the Chinese about their personnel in the East. Very important distinction to make here that the miners in the East are very different than the contractual disputes with the mining companies that's going on in Kinshasa and Lualaba province. So just those are two separate tracks that some people oftentimes confuse and overlap with each other. Okay, Cobus, woo, a lot to digest this week. Let's start kind of winding this up a little bit. Good and bad, what were you pleasantly surprised from FOCAC? What let you down?
I guess, like, letdown, I think, is a letdown that we already mentioned, is that there's so little engagement on the issue of debt. And the fact that there has been essentially no engagement also from the G20 over the last while, and still, like, not even no engagement, but no platforms for engagement, no methods to engage with all of the kind of private sector and Eurobond lenders to Africa, makes me kind of gloomy about the debt situation in certain African countries. I mean, you know, one shouldn't kind of pretend that the entire African continent is in a debt crisis, but some African countries do have debt problems, and it made me a little kind of like pessimistic about the future of those. I think the thing that made me, you know, optimistic or cautiously optimistic was the fact that for the first time that FOCAC put out a separate, you know, kind of statement on a single issue, separate statement happened this time at FOCAC, and it was a shared kind of initiative on climate change, like an Africa-China climate change kind of statement and initiative. It's still very vague. We're still not 100% sure like what all of these things are going to be, but there's a lot of commitments to cooperation on many, many aspects of kind of climate change related. Climate mitigation, climate adaptation, like green development, you know, and I scanned it, and I need to read it in more detail. But like I didn't see a lot of kind of mentions of natural gas in there. It seemed to be quite kind of focused on actual, you know, actual renewable kind of energy. So I think that was a pleasant surprise, you know, kind of that they actually put out a separate kind of document on it that it clearly is now a big kind of like area of cooperation. So it's going to be interesting to see what comes out.
So my area of disappointment, it's not really disappointment, it's hope mixed with disappointment, is they talked about this establishment of new, what they're calling green lanes to facilitate the import process or the export from Africa importing to China of agricultural products. One of the lessons that we learned from the avocado fiasco in Kenya from, I think, a year or two ago, was they approved the importation of Kenyan avocados to China. Wonderful. Everybody was excited. This is a fruit that has a much higher profit margin than some other commodities like coffee. So great. But what ends up happening is that the whole process falls down when there's technology that needs to flash freeze the avocados, there's a whole packaging process, and ultimately it never lived up to the potential because the follow-through just wasn't there. So I'm hoping that with the establishment of these new green lanes, that they will actually then come through with funding, training, and help in order to facilitate the exportation of African agricultural products to China to actually live up to the potential that's there. The other concern right now about exporting too much food into China, which is good to balance out the trade, as you've talked about, trade is a really critical issue. But in a lot of African countries, we are facing some food security questions. And Africa is already a region that imports the bulk of its food. And so maybe we'd like to see more development of African agriculture for domestic markets and not for export. So lots of pressures that are there. One very quick point before we go on the debt issue, as you pointed out. What's happening now in Ghana and Kenya that is of real concern is the currency is depreciating. So the shilling has gone down 22% in the past few weeks, and the cedi is also under pressure in Ghana as well. That makes servicing the debt in dollars even more expensive. So this crisis on debt that nobody seems to want to talk about in any serious way is only getting worse because of the deteriorating value of a number of African currencies. So it's not just the fact that the debt numbers are going up, but the value of the currency that's used to pay for it is going down. Lots of pressure that's there. So let's leave the conversation there. So much going on. This is exactly why we do our newsletter. This is why we put together the website. If you go to the website, you can search for all of the stories that we've covered on this. You'll need a subscription. It's super reasonable. $7 for students and teachers, $15 for everybody else. We're so thrilled this week. We had a big surge of subscribers, obviously around FOCAC. So that was very exciting. We hope that people will spread the word. Again, go to ChinaAfricaProject.com/subscribe. But if you'd like a more casual engagement on this, you're just not ready for such an intense thing, our Patreon community is great. You get a weekly digest as part of your support for us. We do Zoom calls. We're also providing updates, and we do a regular bonus podcast there as well. So that's a lot of fun. Go to patreon.com/ChinaAfricaProject. Okay, that'll do it for this edition of the show. Kobus and I will be back again next week. We only did one show this week because we were waiting for all the events to stop because we didn't want to do a show and then have it dated. And so we ended up only doing one show, but we will be back to two shows starting next week. We have some fantastic guests to close out the year. Walter Rigu is going to be joining us to talk about he's our trade expert out of China, and what is selling, what is actually going on the ships, and we'll talk about supply chains. And we also have Andy Mok coming to us from the China Center for Globalization, which is a Chinese think tank, and going to give us a Chinese perspective on FOCAC as well. And we're going to be talking African infrastructure next week. So lots of great shows. And at the very end of the year, it's my favorite show of the year. We do the year in review, year in preview, and that's going to come at the very end. We're going to take a little bit of a break for a couple of weeks for the holidays, but so we have some great episodes lined up for you guys between now and then. So that'll do it. For Kobus van Staden, I'm Eric Olander. Thank you so much for listening.
The discussion continues online. Head over to facebook.com/ChinaAfricaProject to share your thoughts on today's show. For more information about the China Africa Project, go to ChinaAfricaProject.com.